Are you ready to get serious about building content sites and building a profitable business online? Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. We bring you the latest field-tested tips, tricks, and strategies for building a profitable online asset. We interview industry experts, share customer success stories, and reveal our own experiences working on hundreds of sites to inspire and motivate you to make something happen. Let's do this.
Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. Today we have Thomas Jepson. If you on SEO Twitter, you probably know of Thomas. He's done a lot of different case studies on there. He tends to find a lot of Ahrefs graphs that are mooning, talks about them on there. But before we dive into some of these case studies, we actually talk about his previous, local lead gen sites, the things he's done there. And then we move into some of these case study similarities. What are these sites doing in common that are essentially making them successful? We also cover some of the common problems that sites that he's audited run into as well. So things that you can do for your own site and diagnose yourself. And then we go into some of his current content and e-commerce sites and what he's doing there, traffic and things like that. I should actually add one more thing is his controversial take on topical authority. Obviously, topical maps and topical authority is, I guess, a trend within SEO and niche websites currently. Here's a different take on that too near the end of the episode. So sit back and enjoy.
This episode is brought to you by Niche Website Builders, an agency dedicated to helping people just like you build profitable content sites. Niche Website Builders are the hands-off content site marketing agency you always wished existed. It's run by content site marketers for content site marketers, and they help both investors and individuals alike build profitable online properties. They provide a fully outsourced approach to content creation, link building, and done-for-you website builds, the same approach they use on their own six-figure portfolios. For example, their content packages come with a proprietary keyword research process, are written by in-house native English speakers, formatted using templates proven to convert, and uploaded to WordPress with affiliate links added so that all you need to do is hit the publish button. Check them out at nichewebsite.builders/show. That's nichewebsite.builders/show and fill out the form to get coupon codes for 10% more content or a 10% discount on links with your first order sent right to your inbox.
All right. Welcome to the Niche Website Builders Podcast. Today, we have Thomas Jepson. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you for having me on.
No, thank you for coming on. I think most people kind of know you as the case study guru on Twitter. With everything you're doing on there. So do you want to maybe give a brief background about yourself and we can dive into some of those?
Sure. I was kind of a bored teenager during high school and figured I wanted to make some money and somehow started out by selling USB sticks on eBay, ordering them from China, and pretty quickly found out that was a bad idea because it took like a month or two to actually show up, and then all of them were just fakes and didn't work. And somehow ended up doing SEO and started learning SEO, and my parents were probably thinking, why the heck is he spending so much time on the computer? And so moved to Denmark from Belgium, where I grew up, and got a job at an online marketing agency. Was the first hire there, and we were about 30 people by the time I left. Put up a couple of sites, accidentally got into home improvement, and was contacted by a company that does that sells leads to contractors. And all of a sudden, well, we did a test project, and they said, "Hey, do you wanna collect leads instead of show ads?" And this is back in the AdSense days. And I said, sure, let's give it a go. And my revenue numbers tripled, quadrupled basically overnight as a consequence. So that was pretty substantial. And that was back in the good old 2014, 15, 16, when you could put up anything near me. And it was before Google managed to localize a bunch of searches, and I had a site in home improvement that was On the best days, I was doing just over 100 home improvement leads a day. And wow. Revenue-wise, that was about $21,000 in revenue. And so this was before I graduated. So I was writing my master thesis at the same time.
So you're balling while at college.
Yeah, well, workaholic. And then you hit something and it works really, really well. And so, writing my master thesis, absolutely hating that project. And I guess my professor, he kind of figured that I wasn't super into it. So he goes, Thomas, here's the good news. I trust you. You can ask me for as much help as you want, but it's up to you how much help you want. And basically he was saying, stay out of my line of sight. I don't want to deal with you. Show up for the exam. So that's what I did. Barely passed and got my visa to the US before the day before I graduated. And then basically just left and moved over to the US. 3 or 4 months later, my site lost 85-90% of traffic.
Oh, man.
Basically overnight. So
damn. That's one story. How did you accidentally get into home improvement then?
Somehow I got a site on siting contractors, and this was back when you just it seemed like a good exact match domain to have. CPCs were pretty high, and the search volume and the competition metrics kind of looked good. So it was kind of a sheer coincidence and just, you know, ended up putting up a really poor content website back when the themes, they were just optimized for AdSense. And then that was kind of the beginning of it. And on top of that, while studying, I always had a job next to it also. And we basically had a bunch of home improvement contractors and whatnot that were clients also. So kind of a lot of venues for me to be exposed to the industry.
So when you were selling these leads, how were you pricing them? Or was that done through, I think you mentioned a company approached you about that?
Yeah. So first approached by a company called Networks, and you basically negotiate with them. My focus was just rather than optimizing on the revenue on the basis of every single lead, getting increasing traffic was just so ridiculously easy that it seemed it seemed easier to just increase traffic and then subsequently focus on, you know, squeezing out more money out of every single lead. But down the line, I ended up integrating with a PingPost software called PX. And what that did was I started working with Home Advisor, which is the biggest name in contractor leads. So every time there was a lead that came in, this software would then ping Home Advisor as well as Networks and a couple of other companies I ended up partnering up with as well. And then they send back the best price for the lead, and then you sell it to the highest bidder.
Ah, interesting. Okay. So are you on a model where you get paid per lead or per conversion?
Per lead.
Per lead.
Which is the only way to do it, because I've found out that over here in the US, the amount of contractors that actually pick up the phone is very, very low. You do not want to get paid on the basis of conversion, but I raised some money to scale that, and that didn't necessarily go the way we wanted it to, and ended up exiting. So I'm no longer generating home improvement leads, and have moved on to other stuff.
Gotcha. I'll come back to that in a sec. But you mentioned you moved to the US, and then it was that site that got massively hit. Down 85%. So what did you do then? Obviously, was that your only revenue stream at that time? You moved to the States for a job, or just that was like it?
I figured out that my legs needed more sun than Denmark was providing. So and kind of like the openness of the country over here. And if you want to raise money and do serious startup stuff, I mean, it's kind of the country that you have to be in. And so that was kind of my justification for coming over. What was your second question?
As your site that got hit, was that your only revenue stream when you came over?
Yep, that was my only revenue stream. And yep, I mean, luckily by that time I had decent savings.
Yeah.
And I mean, I managed and, you know, grinded for a long bit and kind of somewhat ended up recovering it. Hindsight, you know, 2016 was the year. It probably deserved to get punished because I was potentially dabbling a little bit too much in, like, you know, borderline black hat stuff. And when I was also trying to scale a little bit too quickly, and all of a sudden I found out that my content provider had not been doing decent QA on all the articles going through. So his writers had more or less just taken articles and then, you know, swapped out some level of words in there. And it meant that it passed Copyscape, but it basically meant that, you know, Google could still see that it was just poorly plagiarized.
Okay, I gotcha. So did you then start creating new sites as you were building that to kind of, I guess, diversify yourself away from that one site?
I figured it would be fun to raise VC funding.
Oh, wow.
So I basically got rid of a good level of penalties on it. And then I figured what would be more stupid than to go out, raise some funding. And my thesis was, okay, there are all these sites with great backlinks doing just a horrible job when it comes to content. So basically I wanted to go out and find underutilized websites, redirect them to my site, have them turn into like a domain authority monster that could compete against HomeAdvisor and go down that route and raise some money and started redirecting. And it went well to a certain extent, but I don't think I got rid of the underlying penalties to the extent that I needed. So, I mean, it grew bigger from like where it was when it was penalized, but it never kind of managed to achieve what we'd been hoping it would do.
So you mentioned you exited that site, right?
Yeah.
How are you able to share any numbers?
Yeah, $300,000 was the sales price, and I mean, as much as it pains me, because the site was probably worth like $600,000-$700,000 at the peak.
Mm.
But I mean, I took home some money and the VC took home some money and I'm doing better stuff. And so life is good.
No, that's good. Are you still doing local lead gen then? Is that kind of like your bread and butter?
No. No, it just doesn't get me very excited.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not easy to exit. And I either want to build something where it just throws off a ridiculous amount of passive income, or I want to build something that has a really fat exit. And I don't really think that the local SEO focus fits into either one of those two.
Gotcha. So what are you building now then that fits those criteria?
Content site is one of them, kind of fits the potential to just be a lot of passive income coming my way and pretty good growth there. And then on top of that, there's a e-commerce project I'm working on. And on top of that, I'm kind of setting myself up to ideally raise SaaS money in a year or two. So starting with all the content related stuff. So ideally I built the pipeline and I built all the leads coming in, and then I push VC and I say, hey, I've raised VC before. I have all these guys wanting this product that does not exist. Give me some money and let's build it.
So the VC route is, it's interesting. It's unique, especially in this content, I guess, niche website space as well. Why go down that road versus just kind of building yourself? So, I mean, with VC money, you're giving away equity in your brand. Yeah. So why go down that road versus kind of building yourself and trying, I guess, owning 100%, if that makes sense.
Because if you find the right VC and the right partner that align with your vision, essentially you can just, I mean, the moon's the limit. And over here, you raise a seed million of a seed round of $1 million, and it's not even all that. I mean, it's not anything that's going to make it onto the front page of TechCrunch. So it's more about just making the money work for you. And I mean, grinding and bootstrapping, it's just only fun to a certain extent. So if I can give up a little bit of equity and actually much quicker build a much larger team, then I think my realistically, I'm going to be able to reach the goals that I want quicker.
Gotcha. So what are you looking for then in a suitable VC that would help you grow your site? Is it someone that's in that same industry that maybe has connections and things?
There needs to be an understanding of the power structure between the VC and the entrepreneur. There needs to be an understanding of what's the timeline, what do we do if it doesn't work out. Mm-hmm. And you need to make sure that VC is also a lot of paperwork. So you need to make sure that that you align on what's required of you. What are you allowed to do without having board approval, and kind of the more technical side of raising money and all of that.
What makes it, I guess, what stage do you need to be in to look to raise money? Because I'm assuming if you just have, let's just take your content side, for example, let's just assume it's just display ads and maybe affiliate monetization. I guess, what stage do you need to be in to look to raise VC money? I'm assuming just a straight content display ad site, you're not going to raise VC money to expand it, correct? Or is that, or am I wrong on that? Maybe that's something you could still raise VC money to look to expand even further. It's like a big media brand or something.
I've actually talked to a media brand, and I think they raised $1 million, and it's mainly just a media play. But history determines what you're able to do, as well as connections. Some of the stories of, you know, an investor taking out a napkin and putting down numbers on it, and that's an early term stage term sheet. I actually know friends where, you know, we may not be talking about them raising literal millions like that, but in the kind of $500,000 range, that's not inconceivable that happens. Some people raise money before they even have a product, and especially if they've managed to have successful startups in the past. But very much so, it comes down to the risk aversion, risk desire of an investor, and how excited you're able to get them. So it's very individual.
Where do you find, if someone wanted to maybe do this, where do you actually start? Like, where do you find a VC? Is there somewhere online that you start posting, or you have to start calling a few people?
There's a lot to it. There's not really one specific way to do it. The way that I managed to get in touch with the VC that I raised money from was I, through a roommate at the time, I got in touch with the investor's daughter who was very active in the startup scene. Then I threw a SEO workshop, and basically at the office of the VC. And then I just hustled and harassed the VC until they eventually took a meeting with me. But I mean, Crunchbase, trying to figure out which VCs and investors are relevant in the space that you're trying to build stuff, because a lot of them have very strict theses that they're following. So some of them will only do SaaS, and some of them will only do, marketplaces. And some of them are focused on minorities. So it really depends on what you're trying to build. But a bunch of them also want to support local businesses. And at least the one I was working with, they were more so focused here in the Southeast.
Okay. Now, that's interesting. Hopefully that's helpful for anyone looking to potentially go down that road. But I wanted to move on to your Twitter. And you post a lot of case studies on there, and you seem to find, I don't know how, you seem to find graphs every day on Ahrefs of mooning websites and estimating how much they're making and things like that. But within your case study, you've obviously seen a lot of different sites and analyzed a lot of different sites. I was wondering if you could maybe dive into some of the similarities between the sites that are doing really well that you're finding. Like, what are they doing that maybe other people aren't doing, or what are they all doing that's common?
Yeah. So one thing where I disagree with the Google messaging is I controversially believe that one of the metrics that Google believes is important is, in fact, word count. And that's not to say that word count's the end-all, be-all. But I do tend to find that I see sites with word counts above 1,000 words tend to do better in general. But what I've seen in a bunch of when I've done audits for sites and whatnot is you can artificially lower that number by having a lot of index bloat. So if you are on a platform where accidentally you index archive pages and you index various category pages and tag pages and all of that, these are pages that tend to have very low word counts. So, in my opinion, it makes a bunch of sense. Basically, Google has limited resources to index and process everything. So when they come across just proportionally sites that have very low word counts and they have to spend like a decent amount of computer resources just actually processing this stuff. So rather than word count necessarily being, obviously it's not the sole indicator of quality, because there's so much you can do wrong on a long page. But it shows some level of consideration towards Google that you're not just trying to have them waste resources on stuff that shouldn't be updated. So that's one. I think with the HCU updates that we've seen a couple of now, I think in an attempt to fight AI content, they've increased the importance of good formatting. And from a usability standpoint, I think it makes sense also, because it's, for one, it makes content easier to read. But my suspicion is also that while Google may have relaxed their stance a little bit on like, oh, is AI okay to use on your sites? I think AI is less likely to do a decent job at formatting. at least with when you put in simple queries. So I think in part there's that also. And I mean, they want to continue increasing and improving the user experience. So I think that's becoming increasingly important.
What do you see as good formatting on the patch? Because I guess the word count and I guess even the formatting is more user experience rather than say technical SEO. But what do you see as formatting that Google likes?
Something like shorter sentences, breaking up sentences, using lists, using appealing imagery, and basically whatever they can read in HTML format that adds to the formatting. And I think those are the main components that people should be looking to.
Gotcha. What's your take on custom imagery then? And do you think stock images have any kind of positive or negative effect?
Yeah, I think it depends on the type of content you're creating. So I think basically with the product reviews updates, we're seeing that Google is treating some content very differently from others. So I think in terms of affiliate content, I think it makes a lot of sense to make custom imagery, have custom imagery. When it comes to content that's not affected by review algorithms, I don't believe that there's any marginal benefit to it.
Okay, that's good. It's interesting you mentioned about the AI as well, because yeah, obviously Google mentioning that they're okay with AI content, and I know there's a couple people like yourself, like you just mentioned, who are a little skeptical around the idea of using AI still and trusting Google's stance there. I mean, they could potentially just rug pull everyone using AI in the future. You never know. It's interesting. Way. Does that mean then? Is AI assisted content in something that you would consider, or is that still okay? It's generated from AI, so I still won't touch it. I'd rather have a human write the entire thing.
Yeah, I get help with some stuff, but I want to clarify my stance on it. I'm not saying AI content's not working if done correctly. I'm saying it's a matter of risk tolerance, and my current risk tolerance does not align very well with me designing huge proportions of AI content. So more so than anything, it's about making sure that the people sitting out there and actually listening to this that are just getting started, that they understand that Google for a very long time has been against auto-generated content, and that is exactly what AI content is. So if you go down the route of actually just filling up your site with a bunch of AI content, I believe that you are vastly increasing the risk of getting penalized. But I think the ChatGPT, I think it's capable of coming up with very clever topic ideas and provide some level of input. And I mean, say you want to include some lists, you can ask ChatGPT for ideas and lists to include. And so to that extent, I believe that AI can definitely be an assistant and help you out in the creation. But it's the way I see it, it's more so the level at which you do it. And I mean, at what point you get penalized, I have no idea. Is it when Google can basically tell that, you know, half your content is AI generated? Probably. Will they do it if they believe 10% is AI generated? Probably not. But I'm obviously not a Google engineer. I have no clue if that's actually how they do it, or, you know, what tomorrow is going to bring. And as you said, if they change their mind tomorrow, or like where the thresholds are, I don't know.
How do you think, this is a loaded question, but how do you think things might change when GPT-4 comes out? Because obviously that's a bigger, even bigger data set, more powerful AI. Is that going to supercharge the AI content on the internet?
Yes, I think it will. I mean, from my understanding, it's supposed to make it faster. And I believe it's going to make it more difficult to for Google to actually detect AI content. But I mean, I'm not an AI engineer, but that's my guess. I'm still one of the people that absolutely hates AI as a search product. I think it's ingrained in us that we want options. We want to feel connected to some human being on the other side. Yeah. And I mean, I have a vested interest in being right, of course, but it's, yeah, when version 4 comes out, I can only speculate. And we obviously had some very interesting situation that happened when Google was, you know, doing their presentation, and all of a sudden their presentation just goes off the rails and the stock price goes down by 7%. So I don't want to be a fear monger. And I believe that search still has to exist.
That's hopefully good news for anyone listening. But I wanted to come back to the word count too before we go into any other similarities. But are you looking to match or slightly exceed maybe the word count of, say, the top three results for a certain search term? Or are you just writing to fulfill the query and you don't really mind in terms of if it matches what's already out there?
I like going for queries that has at least 1,000 words in them of potential content that can be written. And I mean, for a couple of reasons, I think that they're less, Google is less likely to put up, say, a snippet that just is gonna, I mean, very, very simple queries, Google can just serve up the answer, like, what's the weather? You're not going to write 1,000 words about what the weather is like outside. So it comes down to keyword selection and that just mainly being my focus. And then, choosing queries where that's the case.
Gotcha. Are there any other similarities on some of those case studies that you have seen on page or off page?
Similarities in what sense?
Those are the case studies that you've done on Twitter in terms of things they're doing, I guess things that they're all doing that is essentially potentially making them successful.
I mean, this whole word count theory comes from me looking at a lot of sites. So whenever I go into a site and I see a lot of index bloat, that you can usually track it on the ranking charts also. So when it comes to these case studies that I'm doing, usually they have pretty good word counts, at least the case studies that are doing well. Needless to say, I have come across a couple of case studies where there's this one case study I did where they were actually selling live cockroaches for bearded dragons. The case study completely flunked. I thought it was going to do great, and I guess people don't want to see cockroaches show up on their computer screens. I was a little disappointed. I figured they scrolled down on Twitter, and all of a sudden there's a cockroach just popping out. it would catch their attention. But surprisingly, that site, I want to say that their median word count was like 500-600 words, something like that at least.
That would probably be considered a lower competition niche, I'm assuming, than selling cockroaches to beta dragons.
I mean, surprisingly, not a whole lot of people want to sell live cockroaches.
Yeah.
And I just I just wonder how often the some of them escape, and all of the sudden they just have 100,000 of them just running around the house. At least I know that would not be appreciated here.
Yeah, that's a new niche for anyone listening they can get into. But if someone wants to figure out if they do have some form of index bloat, how do they do that?
Screaming Frog is a good one. Basically, digging into Google Search Console, and you can go in and see what the index pages are, and see if there's anything on that list that you're thinking, hey, should this really be indexed? Do I have is it actually worthy content? Is there either a traffic reason or a strategic reason why this page is being indexed? And the more of that content that you see, the more likely you are that you're being penalized. And I've audited some horror stories when it comes to index bloat, and it's like, oh, we're gonna have to do a whole lot of cleaning up before you're gonna see any interesting results, unfortunately.
What would sway your decision whether to no index or index, say, a category page? Is it only if you're trying to maybe rank for a seed term that you'd keep it index? Otherwise, you just straight no index category pages?
So e-commerce, it makes sense to keep them indexed. Yeah. But, I mean, then again, you also have to make sure that they actually have some content, that they're probably properly keyword optimized. And so there's kind of different levels to it. When it comes to news sites, also there's a lot of reasons not to know index category pages. So, does it bring you traffic? Could it bring you traffic? Is it just a thin page? Does it serve? If it doesn't serve some level of goal, I mean, what's it really doing for you except improving crawlability a little bit? But I mean, in my opinion, you ought to have a strategy to make crawlability so good that you don't necessarily have to rely on category pages that you don't want to be filling up, and or that some people choose to not fill up properly.
Okay. And what can people do to improve their crawlability around their site?
Internal linking. I mean, that's really the main part. Make sure that you have sitemaps in Search Console. Being strategic about internal linking, and you know, a little shout out to Link Whisper. I'm unaffiliated, but they do a pretty good job, and you without having to have an expensive Ahrefs subscription, Link Whisper will also let you know if you have orphan pages that don't get linked to. And so it's just a good tool with a lot of function, and that's basically how you increase crawlability.
Do you have a, I guess, framework or guideline with how you interlink between pages? Are you looking to exact match every internal link, or are you looking at kind of broader anchor text?
Ideally relevant. I don't think you're going to get penalized for either over-optimized internal links or, you know, borderline relevant internal links. I believe that you're basically just passing PageRank around, and then it's a very sophisticated math equation that you know, none of us can understand to the fullest extent, ideally you're also clustering keywords so that you can naturally link between articles without having it be forced, but you know, with that said, I've definitely linked from very unrelated pages to just highly strategic and important pages, and have not seen rankings do anything bad as a consequence.
Gotcha. I know you mentioned you audit quite a few sites and you've had some horror stories there. Are there common problems that you come across with the sites you audit that maybe common mistakes they're all making, or at least maybe a handful of them are making that you find, common?
Index bloat. I mean, we've spoken a lot about it. Yeah. That's really, really, really common cleaning up. And surprisingly, even with established companies and not even just SEO sites, a bunch of them just index left and right, like they don't even care. I mean, everyone can do a better job of improving formatting and really figuring out how does your site stack up to what Google is currently ranking at the top, because you know you're still trying to manipulate an algorithm, and for whatever reason they've decided that your site is not the one that should be at the top of Google, but that the number 1 to 5. So a lot of it is also just kind of opening up the minds to the owner of the site as to what competitors are doing better, because we're all stubborn. Hell, I'm extremely stubborn myself. So you don't want to be told that you're doing something wrong, but when you do commit to a paid audit, someone comes in and takes on a clean pair of glasses and says, "Hey, you put up 500 words, there are 1,000. They have custom imagery, they have formatting, they have supporting pages, they interlink decently. I mean, there's a reason why you're not number one." I also focus my audits on. I mean, I sit down with the owner first, and I say, "Hey, let me understand what you've done. Let me understand what's happened, what's working, what's not working. Let's see if we can establish some patterns, and then let's figure out where it is you want to go." So besides just the technical SEO aspect of it, there's also a let's make sure that this actually means there's money coming into your bank account, and that you're not just paying for nothing.
Gotcha. And I know you mentioned you've got a few of your own sites. Do you want to maybe dive into some of your content site, depending, you can share as much or as little as you want, niche, age of the site, traffic, growth, monetization, all that stuff?
I've shared one that's on my Twitter that
is that the one that was bouncing around?
But you know, the magic of trying to scale too quickly and not having my SEOs nailed down, and I think that's the reason. And so that one right now is just going through the roof on Ahrefs. It's at a pretty nice record yesterday, and it's record for a Sunday, mind you. Today is going to look pretty because today, I don't know when you're going to publish, but Mondays are usually my best days. So I have an expectancy that that's going to be 2,500 visitors today or so. But I'm pretty, if you follow me on Twitter, I'm pretty convinced that in the weeks coming up that the numbers are going to be very, very pretty. Another site I have is a small attempting to make it a lead gen site that was an e-commerce platform. I managed to buy an e-commerce platform right before COVID, which wouldn't be bad if it hadn't been in PPE equipment. So all of a sudden, my couldn't buy the equipment I was used to, and couldn't warehouses had issues staffing and all of this. Yeah, I don't share much about that, but trying to turn that into lead gen and kind of revamping and ideally having an exit off of it, but I guess we'll see where that lands.
Nice. So with the original content site, you mentioned around 2,500 visitors yesterday. So how many articles are on that site and how old's the site?
400-ish articles. It was up to about 600 and then it tanked. And then I decided to no index a bunch of articles and then at the same time also improve the quality of the remaining ones. It was a domain I picked up, spent $6,000 or $7,000 or so on the domain, had never been expired, but basically it was just an old website with a bunch of good links and extremely poor content. And I figured there's got to be a better way to put this to use. But the exact age of the domain, I'm not sure.
So how did you decide which ones to no index? Were they the ones that were on the site already, those blog posts when you bought it?
I think there was about 6,000 or 7,000 posts on the site when I bought it. Took that down to about 100, 150, something like that. So there was a lot of cutting. And so when the penalty came around, the algorithmic penalty or readjustment or whatever you want to call it, I took a lot of the lowest performing articles and I said, okay, not doing anything for traffic or for revenue anyway. And I mean, I should have followed my own advice anyway and said, look, if there's no strategic purpose and it's not achieving anything, why am I keeping it? So removed a bunch of that, improved stuff. And then I brought some stuff back online again. Then my site tanked again. And then just recently, it made a full recovery, and as mentioned yesterday, was a record for Sunday. And now I'm pretty convinced. Now I think we're good. I've gotten a lot more strict with the pages that I'm reviving, and I've basically had VAs help me upgrade a bunch of the stuff. And just figure out why am I better than the competitors, or why should Google be serving my stuff instead of other people?
What's the correct way of deleting all posts? So you deleted like 6,000 or 7,000 posts. Did you end up, because if you just delete them, it ends up being a 404 page. So is there something else that you're doing after deleting them?
I 301 redirected them.
Okay.
And people have different opinions, but I kind of just figured that's 301 and let's not have incoming links go to 404 pages.
Did you 301 to the homepage?
I actually did not. I sent them to, individual articles. Whether or not it helped, I have no idea. But they're not showing up as sub 404s. And I believe that the link juice is still being passed around. Whether Google is determining that they're unrelevant to the original article, I don't know. But my crawl budget is really quite high, so I like to believe that there's at least a lot of the juice being passed around as a consequence.
Yeah, because I had a site that had a lot of old posts, and I ended up, they're just no longer on the site, and I ended up, the ones with links, if I didn't have a relevant article, I just threw on them to the homepage, basically. But as you mentioned, even if it's not relevant, you're still just throw wanting some of those pages just to, even pages that aren't relevant, just to pass the juice through?
So I tried, and nothing bad happened, and I know that SEOs might have different opinions. But for now, it's working. And
interesting.
I guess we'll see if it continues to work or not. And if it does, I'm grateful. If not, I guess I'm going to have to go back to the drawing board.
No, fair enough. So how was that site monetized then?
Mainly ad revenue, some affiliates. I think there are just still so many easy keywords out there, and I tend to go for easy to medium keywords. It's a DR46, DR47 site. So, I mean, I know, you know, everyone's going to hate me for saying DR as a authority measure, but it is still a proxy. But I still think there's just a lot of money to be made from publishing easy to rank for keywords and showing up in Google, and then you get RPMs that are maybe like 30, 40 bucks or so. But you know, when you get enough traffic, then it makes sense. And then all of a sudden, as happened to my previous site, you know, someone reaches out to you and says, "Hey, we're offering this special program. We're going to improve your monetization," and then, you know, ads are no longer the solution.
I had a question in my head right now, and I just completely left my head within that monetization. But I'll move on to my other one. With how are you going? Well, what's the plans to grow this further? Because obviously, ads and affiliate within that. Are you just looking to add more content just to get more ad revenue and more affiliate revenue, or are you looking to maybe branch out? You mentioned obviously you're looking for VCs for certain things. Are you looking to branch out into more kind of digital product or expanding into a big brand?
Kind of depends where the whole AI discussion lands. And if I can get the SOPs right, I believe that I'll just throw a lot of money at mass producing content. And if there's one advice I can that I'm just thinking of right now is use Upwork and use hourly contracts. It's super creepy. But the platform takes a screenshot every 15 minutes or so. And so you're actually making sure that the content you're getting is not AI. And I mean, at least if you're paying for content that's supposed to not be AI, it's kind of nice to have some ability to, besides the detectors, to kind of make sure that it's actual human written content. But my decisions for going forward kind of depends on what happens. And yeah.
Gotcha. And you mentioned around you like to attack those like low to medium competition keywords, squeezing the money out of those. I'd love to hear your thoughts then on the idea of being like a topical authority or having a topical map on a certain topic. And the idea that, okay, you attack those, but then you don't actually attack the maybe high competition keywords that other competitors do have on their sites to fill out that topical map. So are you eventually getting there, or are you just like, I'm just sticking to these low, moderate competition keywords, and then those higher ones can wait till later?
I'm generally not a believer in topical authority, and that's a controversial stance.
Controversial. Go down that road.
My main site, or the site that I put on Twitter, it has your money and your life content. It has home improvement content. It has a bunch of different stuff. So it's not really focused around one specific industry or idea or whatever. And I think the idea of topical authority, I think it's good, because I think it simplifies things for people that are just getting started. With that said, I have seen sites, the cockroach, live cockroach selling site for one. They had a lot of, I mean, you can claim they had so much topical authority from writing everything there is about bearded dragons. But I can also just say that I've seen very successful sites write about a bunch of different topics and have it work for them. And I mean, Google at the end of the day still ranks pages and not websites. And I get that Wikipedia has a next level authority, from links and, you know, all the various signals that Google's looking for. But I can also just say that I'm interlinking irrelevant pages from Your Money or Your Life to Home Improvement, and they're still ranking. So I don't know. I think it makes the debate easier, especially for beginners in the space.
That's an interesting take on it. And actually, just before we finish as well, your e-com site or your PPE site, so you turn that into a potential lead gen site. Is that going to be like a medical lead gen site or something?
No, I found some very expensive devices that, but not non-medical. I believe that I can sell leads for, say, maybe $100-$200 a pop, and then sell them to 2 or 3 companies for each lead. But then again, when you have a product that's like $15,000, $30,000, and you have a very dedicated lead, why would a company not pay $100 for it?
And that would be a private deal with directly with the company.
How do you manage
that relationship? Because I'm assuming they don't have a dashboard, like, for example, that would show conversions and leads. It's more of a handshake agreement.
So that would basically just be me setting up some cool tech that automatically sends it to whatever method of submission that they would want. And then I would imagine that they have some CRM that they can feed it into. They obviously have established sales funnels already. But I've not figured out the management portion of it. That's still kind of, I mean, it's generating some leads, but, you know, you can only focus on so much during the waking hours of the day. And
sure.
I've not gotten around to it just yet.
All good. I think I pretty much covered everything I wanted to ask you there, Thomas. But if someone wants to find you and follow you, maybe buy an audit from you, where can they do that?
Get in touch on Twitter, Jepsen Thomas. That's Jepsen Thomas, Thomas. And I generally try and reply to specific queries, regardless of whether or not I'm consulting anyway. But yeah, I try not take on clients where I don't think I can help them, or where I don't think they're in a good spot for me to help them. And I do turn down clients when it's just not a good fit for whatever reason.
No, fair enough. So if anyone's interested, you can get in touch with Thomas on Twitter. We'll put that down in the description too, so it's easy for you to access as well. But thanks for coming on, Thomas, and sharing everything. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it was good talking with you. I appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you're listening. Until the next episode, goodbye.